Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jeremy Nichols. He's the Climate and Energy Program Director for Wild Earth Guardians and has been active in environmental protection efforts in the American West for over 15 years. Today we're going to talk about coal extraction on public lands in the West. So can you just start by telling me or telling listeners about coal extraction? I think a lot of people might not know much about. I mean, they think they're public lands, and that means that people get to hike on them, and they don't know what else happens.
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, let me set kind of the bigger picture stage. I mean, around 50% of the coal that's mined in the nation comes from the Western United States. Of the coal that's mined in the Western U.S., the vast majority comes from public lands or is publicly owned. So it's a public resource that's managed by the federal government, supposedly in trust for all Americans. The coal that is mined here is shipped to every state, virtually every state, and it's burned in more than, I think at last count, it was like 250 coal-fired power plants. A phenomenal amount. It makes coal mining in the West a root contributor to global warming in the U.S. It ends up being responsible for, of course, the majority of carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants in the nation. And coal-fired power plants are, of course, the single largest source of carbon in the country. So you're talking about the root cause of a very significant threat to our climate. A root cause to, you know, to what is fueling global warming in the U.S. today. Now, an interesting dimension to that has unfolded in the past few years is this issue of coal exports. And this is being talked about a lot in the context of new port proposals that are coming up in the northwestern United States and also in California. But, you know, what people, I think, are realizing now is that coal exporting has been happening for many years. And it's being talked about more because industry is pushing more in that direction as it becomes less and less viable in the United States. The coal industry, of course, is struggling to remain relevant and profitable, so they're now looking overseas. The exports right now from the U.S., they're not huge. It's not like this is a huge, huge problem. I think it might be at most around 10% of the coal that's mined in the West is being shipped overseas, and not just through the West Coast. There's coal that's being shipped to the Gulf of Mexico and even to the East Coast for shipment overseas. So it's not huge, but it is becoming huge and being talked about as the next big thing. And as climate activists, you know, we're not about to let something like coal exports blow up into a major monster. So there's a lot of focus right now in terms of trying to expose exports and to stop them before they get too out of hand. But in the meantime, the West, you know, if you want to talk about, confronting coal in the U.S., if you want to talk about powering past coal in the United States, you have to talk about coal mining in the United States. There's no other way around it. This is where the production is happening, and the West is where it really matters at the end of the day.
You know, you're in Golden, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, I grew up just west of Louisville, and I remember there were some, like, there's a little town called Superior, and
not a little town anymore.
Oh, it was like four people at that point.
Yeah.
And it, if you drive south of Superior, there were some places where you could see some old coal mines. There were basically holes in the side of the, you know, Louisville was originally a mining town for coal. And you could see some little holes where people would go in, and they were still burning from, you know, 100 years ago, the coal seams down there. But my point in bringing all this up is that when you're talking about mines on public lands, you're not actually talking about a person walking into a hole that's 8 feet wide and 8 feet tall. The mining on public lands for coal, for the most part, is not actually underground anymore, is it? Or am I wrong?
Well, no, most of it is not, at least where the most significant amounts of coal are mined. So, you know, here in the West, we have the biggest coal-producing region in the nation. It's called the Powder River Basin, and it's a region that encompasses northeastern Wyoming and southeastern Montana. And around 40% of the nation's coal comes from that region. So in the context of all the Western coal, it is the biggest, and it's the biggest in the nation. No other coal-producing region, even Appalachia, comes close to producing as much coal as the Powder River Basin does. And what they've been able to do is master the technique of monstrous surface mining, basically strip mining at a scale that would have been unimaginable, you know, at the time that they were mining coal here along Colorado's Front Range, you know, where it was a little adit into the mountainside and, you know, a couple of people picking out coal. We're talking about massive drag lines that dwarf most everything in Wyoming. I mean, these drag lines are bigger than the buildings in Wyoming.
How big is a drag line? A big one?
Oh, you know, I mean, there's the length that they can go. Their boom. Oh boy, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I don't want to get it wrong, but I want to say like 100 to 300 feet. I mean, these things are substantial. Maybe even be longer than that.
And what is a drag line? What does that mean?
Well, it's essentially like a crane with a bucket at the end. And what that crane does is it reaches over the land and it drops this bucket, and then there's a cable that pulls the bucket toward the cab of the crane. And these are the drag lines and the drag buckets. And before they even get the drag line in there, what they do is they blast the land. They'll set charges across several acres and blow it up, and blow up the overburden that they can then scrape away to access the coal seams up there. And then the coal seams, I mean,
by overburden, you mean like soil and plants and lizards and everybody who lives there.
Yeah, it's everything on top. It's the stuff that's on top of the coal that the company wants to get out of the way so it can get in the coal. And you know, it's everything there. It could be streams. It could be, you know, sage grouse habitat, sagebrush and cottonwoods. They want to get it out of the way to get the coal. So this is, and it's interesting because it's almost like reverse mountaintop removal. I mean, these are the plains up in Wyoming. There's not really mountains, but it's the same technique. You know, you're essentially removing what they feel is unnecessary, and what's unnecessary is the plains. And so they're digging pits into the ground and not taking tops off mountains, but pits. So kind of upside down mountaintop removal in a way. And they dig down several hundred feet. And they are accessing coal seams up there. I mean, one of the reasons that the Powder River Basin has become such a menace, I think, in terms of the overall production of coal in the country is because you have immense, immense amounts of coal. You have 100-foot thick coal seams in that region. Mines elsewhere in the West, you know, they're lucky to get a coal seam that's 10 feet thick. And then they're able to, you know, construct and engineer these massive pieces of equipment, these massive drag lines to scrape away that coal, and then massive trucks that haul it to their processing facilities. And then, you know, trains that are a mile long that are leaving the coal mines, you know, every hour and moving coal to all corners of the country. And as I mentioned earlier, what we're seeing increasingly to ports that are hauling the coal overseas. So it's unbelievable the scale of industrialization that coal mining has brought to the Powder River Basin. And it's been fueled by the fact that our federal government oversees this coal, and our feds are not the best at managing our public resources, one, but they're not the best at ensuring industry pays the full value of the coal. They're very comfortable essentially giving it away at any cost, because in the federal government's mind, any money is good money. So it's been a very unfortunate system that's developed over the years, and what it's incentivized, which is this huge dependence on the Powder River Basin for our energy, and the entrenchment of the coal industry as a very powerful destroyer of the environment up there.
So there's a couple directions I want to go. One is, you mentioned the economics of this, and as having done a lot of forest activism, I know that the timber sales they were selling at just a fraction of the price, and we know that with public lands grazing, they make the grazers on the ranchers on public lands pay, what is it, 25% or 20% or 15% of market value. what are some of the numbers on the market value that, I mean, how much do these leases cost versus the value that is extracted from them? Is it like, do they pay?
In terms of what they cost, I mean,
we're going to talk about environmental costs later. I just want economic costs for a second, and then we'll go to environmental costs.
Well, just to illustrate an example of this particular issue, I mean, recently coal leases in the Powder River Basin have been selling for $1 a ton, so $1 per ton of coal. I challenge anybody to come up with anything that you can buy in this world for $1 a ton. I can't get $1. A dollar worth of mulch, not going to be very much. And yet these coal companies are paying $1 for this incredibly valuable resource that they are turning around and selling to utilities to burn and generally making a very, very handsome profit at the end of the day. People have said, oh my God, if the feds just increase the cost by $1 or two, $2, $3 a ton, which on its face is insanely cheap. We could be recovering much, much more value. But the federal government, as you mentioned, with timber sales, with grazing, I mean, they're not profit makers. They view their business as serving industry and helping industry meet its ends. And it's this mindset where, they feel like they have to subsidize industry, timber industry, the agricultural industry and the coal industry, to make America better. And, some things we do need to subsidize in this country, and it's worthwhile to subsidize, but to subsidize a profit making endeavor, for the interests of the profit maker, that idea has done. We should be done with that by now. But unfortunately we're not. And unfortunately, the stakes are so much higher, honestly, when it comes to coal. The timber wars, we've made significant progress. It's great. We were able to restore some forests that have been lost over the years. Once coal is mined and burned, putting that carbon back into the ground is nearly impossible.
I think that they need to subsidize these industries to make sure that the free market actually works. That was a joke. So how big are some of these mines?
Yeah. So, I mean, what I was going to say is that, I mean, what's happened, because there's subsidization of coal mining in the Powder River Basin, which has led to that region becoming the biggest coal producing region in the nation. What happens in the Powder River Basin affects the overall coal markets in the U.S. because it's such a significant portion of the product that's being, produced and consumed. And so by subsidizing the market up there, they've effectively subsidized the coal markets nationwide and have created a situation where coal is a lot cheaper than it should be. And that's not even taking into account the environmental costs, which, you mentioned earlier. Let's set those aside for now. Let's just look at some of the more direct costs here. And, by allowing companies to buy up coal cheap and then sell it for much higher prices, yeah, they've given an incentive for coal to take hold and to become our dominant source of electricity. It's a crazy situation that they've set up.
So let's talk about how big are some of these mines?
Acreage-wise is deceiving because these are giant pits in the ground going after 100-foot thick coal seams. Let's look at it in the context of volume. The biggest mines up there produce around 100 million tons a year. There's two mines that produced more than 100 million tons nationwide last year. The U.S. total coal that's produced is around a billion tons of coal annually. And, we have two mines in the Powder River Basin that are producing more than 100 million tons. So right there's two mines up there that are responsible for 20% of our nation's coal. Then you add on some of the other big strip mines up there that are getting 50 million, 40 million, 30 million tons. Massive, massive mines. The biggest mines in Appalachia are producing, maybe at the most like 15 to 20 million tons, but that's an anomaly. Usually around 10 million tons or lower. I know other mines here in the West. We have other mines. There's some underground mines, some fairly sizable underground mines. But even then, those types of mining operations are only getting, at the most 10 million tons out of the ground. So it's just the scale. It's on a whole different level in the Powder River Basin, and it's what makes the West so significant in terms of overcoming coal in the United States.
So let's talk about some of the direct environmental effects of. We'll talk about global warming again in a moment, but let's talk about the direct environmental effects of these mines. I mean, obviously, if you remove the soil and you take out, you make this big pit in the ground, that's not going to make very good pronghorn antelope habitat.
No. I mean, they're destroying the ground. I mean, they're ripping everything up. They're putting thousands of acres out of commission. Now, ostensibly, we have reclamation standards and a federal law that requires reclamation at coal mines, but there's no requirement that says when that reclamation has to happen. You know, it's interesting. There is a requirement for what's called contemporaneous reclamation. And what this means is that the general standard is if you disturb an acre, you should be reclaiming an acre. So you don't end up in a situation where you've dug everything up and you've done no reclamation, so now you have to go back and reclaim everything. And in the meantime, you know, chaos has broke loose because you've disturbed so much soil, there's been so much erosion. So we ostensibly have standards that require companies to be spending time and money on reclaiming the land, but they don't. The ratio of disturbed acreage to reclaimed acreage, like in the Powder River Basin, is sometimes like 30 to 1, you know, 30 acres of disturbance for every 1 acre of reclamation. And it varies, but even then the reclamation amounts to they threw grass seed out. And this is an area where sagebrush should be dominant. And you can't just throw sagebrush seeds out on the ground and expect them to grow. It's a very harsh environment. And for sagebrush to take hold and be able to withstand that harsh environment, it needs enough water. It needs its roots to be able to grow deep enough. And it needs some care and attention, and that's not something that coal companies have been very effective at providing. And you know, it's all belied by the fact that once you destroy this land, once you completely alter its nature and character, you'll never be able to put it back the way it was. And when they're pushing wildlife out, like sage grouse, those grouse aren't coming back. Yeah, they will not come back to that landscape. So. Go ahead.
You know, I've been writing against the mechanistic perspective of perceiving the world as a giant machine for a long time. And even, you know, I've written several books about just that, but I still read something 2 nights ago by a theological philosopher of all things who helped me understand something else, who put it in a really simple way that made a lot of sense to me, which is if you perceive the world or you perceive the difference of perceiving, okay, I can take apart a watch, I can take apart a chair, I can take apart a chair and I can put it back together and I still have a chair. But you can't take apart a body and put it back together and still have a body.
And the scale too up there. I mean, it's beyond. I mean, it's like the arrogance of the engineers up there is, and no offense to engineers. It's just sometimes, you know, we think we can engineer our way out of the biggest problems and make messes and be able to engineer the cleanups. And, we're only human. And I think it's very dangerous for us to think that somehow we can tear apart something so complex and intricate and to be able to put it back together and have it still be alive. And that's the main thing is, sure, you can put dirt back in a pit, but is that place alive? And, you know, I think when you go out there, you see it's generally not.
Well, and I mentioned this in one of the interviews before about just general mining that, you know, having grown up in Colorado, I still saw tailings piles from 30, 40 years ago now, and there's still nothing growing on them. Things happen when you bring there's a reason that the stuff that is underground is underground. When you put it on top, that doesn't mean that you've made the soil. In fact, I was just reading something the other day about how, and this is obvious to anybody who was even thinking about it, that there is tremendous difference in the bacteria in a soil. If you just go 30 feet over, if you change the conditions slightly, the bacterial composition of the soil is going to be completely different. And so if they, for, to think that you can throw this on top and that everything's going to be okay is incredibly, let's be generous and say naive.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very generous.
So let's, before we get to global warming again, how about water quality? What is this doing to water quality in the dry? I mean, I'm presuming this mining uses water. I'm presuming it pollutes water. What does it do?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And, you know, you're mentioning water quality. It's an issue. The main issue is with their, when they dig these pits down, they expose groundwater. And as they mine, they dry out that groundwater and they effectively depress the water tables in the region, which of course has a huge impact on surrounding vegetation and the health of the landscape. They do use water. It is arid though. So a lot of times, they're not dumping massive amounts of pollution into local stream, not like they do back east. But here and there, they'll get a massive storm event that leads to a massive influx of mine tailings into a local draw, and it does work its way downstream. And as far as some of the quality impacts, you know, we don't know as much as we want. We know that digging into the rock of the region, in many areas, it has high selenium content, for example. Selenium, it's very, very poisonous at high levels. There's also arsenic and the coal seams. I mean, you hear the concern about coal ash. Well, ash is just concentrated coal. I mean, it's just the stuff that's in the coal minus the carbon. Here we're talking about massive coal seams, which, yes, there's the carbon, but there's still everything else in there. And as they're exposing these seams and they're weathering, there are a lot of questions over what this means for the local streams of the region and how this arid region can handle that type of pollution. This isn't an area where you can simply dilute your way, out of pollution. There isn't enough water to do that. So I think we're still learning, but there is a lot of concern. I will say that what has really hit people hard is the air pollution impacts associated with these mines. And one issue in particular is when blasting is done at such incredible scales as it is in the Powder River Basin, it leads to the production of toxic orange clouds. And I'm not joking here. Like literally when they blast and they're blowing up the land, the emissions from that blasting form grossly orange to red clouds that if you breathe them, you would die. And they're clouds of nitrogen oxide gases, which is a byproduct of combustion. And where you get enough of it, you start to see it. And you know, all the studies show that when you can see it, it's incredibly life-threatening. And what we have tried to do is to convince the Environmental Protection Agency and other coal overseers to rein in these orange clouds, because there is concern that they drift over local communities, over some of the public lands in the region. I've actually been hiking out there on some of the grassland and seeing these orange clouds. And, you know, you're asking yourself, is this going to drift over me? And what do I do if that happens? They're a very significant problem up there. And I think, you know, a very glaring illustration of how bad coal mining can be from a clean air standpoint. I mean, nothing drives home the story better than a toxic orange cloud. And so, you know, it's air, it's water. These environmental impacts are happening. They're very real. We need to know more, but at the same time, you know, we're trying to do what we can with what we do know to rein in these practices.
You know, when I think of that region, one of the first things that always comes to mind, and this is unfortunately from, you know, when I was growing up, so this is 40 years ago, but the first thing that comes to mind is how incredibly crisp the air was and how extraordinarily clean. So I guess that is no longer.
Yeah, no, I think it's certainly not as frequent of an occurrence. Yeah, I mean, Montana is the big sky state. Wyoming could easily rival Montana as the big sky state. And the only reason you can see so far and so wide and take in such a massive landscape is because the air was so clean. And you know, it's a defining character of the West. I mean, being able to see so far and such amazing landscapes, and to feel a part of them, even though they are so far away. I mean, when you can see those things, your world, I don't know, just becomes more significant, it seems like. And that is it's a rarity. It's a more and more a rarity. And I mean, it's tied to the coal mining. It's tied to, I think, overall industrialization of public lands in the Western United States. I mean, I don't want to get sidetracked, but as this coal mining has taken off in the Powder River Basin, we've also seen booms in oil and gas drilling, you know, train traffic, industrialization, and you know, just other growth that has not done the West clean air any favors.
You know, when we talked before, I remember one of the things we talked about also was noise. And obviously, if there's explosions and drag lines and everything else and trains, there's going to be noise. And once again, I remember it being so quiet that I had a pocket watch and I put it on the ground and I walked about 10 steps away and I could still hear it ticking. I did that because it was so quiet. I wanted to see how far I could go before I wouldn't hear it. And I could hear cows lowing from miles away. And so this is obviously has to make a lot of noise pollution too, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, these are massive operations, large trucks going, the drag lines, the trains. I mean, if you're anywhere near these mines, I mean, the noise is pervasive. It's everywhere and it's day and night. It's, you know, I mean, you cannot avoid it. And it's big. It's big time noise. These are big operations. And then if you want to factor in all the coal trains, I mean, you know, one lonesome train whistle in the middle of the night, that can be a little romantic, but you know, one after the other, hour after hour, day after day, you know, it wears on you for sure.
So, okay. So let's talk about the effects on a bit more about the effects on global warming. And then after that, talk about some of the politics involved. So, you have talked about the importance of this for global warming, but can you talk some more about just give us some numbers and some, I mean, we're basically a study just came out yesterday, and this is once again not a huge surprise that half of the birds in the United States could be in severe trouble because of global warming. And I mean, this is a huge, huge crisis, and take it from there.
Thanks for that introduction. Take it from there. Well, I mean, you know, look, the writing is on the wall that we need to move away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible. And what easier way to do that than by keeping them in the ground in the first place? You know, a ton of coal that's not mined is a ton of carbon that's not released, although it's really like 1.659 tons of carbon. You know, that's like what an easy way to really make some progress in confronting global warming. You know, what's more, why not go after the source of these fossil fuels? It's way more efficient. We can fight 200 smokestacks or we can fight one mine. And we have decided, at least from Wild Earth Guardian's perspective, that it's more efficient and effective to take the fight to the mine. It's not that, you know, the fighting coal-fired power plants isn't worthwhile. It's just, it's going to be a lot more work and the urgency is upon us here. So somebody needs to be taking the fight to the production side of things, to the supply side, basically, and not the consumption side. And we have an immense opportunity in the West, to keep large, huge amounts of carbon in the ground, and to start to make a dent not only on our overall all carbon footprint, but as I was hinting at earlier, like the markets that have allowed fossil fuels to take hold and make us so dependent on these carbon intensive forms of electricity and fuels. So, you know, the aim here is to, okay, look at the Powder River Basin, around 400 million tons of coal are produced there every year. Coal companies are looking to get additional reserves through federal coal leases. They're buying coal from the U.S. Interior Department. We have a twofold approach. One, keeping them from acquiring these new leases. And these leases are sizable. They're approaching 1 billion tons apiece. And one company, Arch Coal, which operates the Black Thunder mine up there, is seeking several of these billion ton leases. You know, if they get a lease, that conveys a right for them to mine. Now, it's not a guarantee they can mine, but it certainly makes it more difficult for us to keep them from mining. So the more leases we can keep from being issued, the better, the more certainty we have that carbon will stay where it is, stay sequestered basically, as opposed to being unleashed. But then our, you know, the second part of that strategy is to get at the existing mining and to start to steadily slow the production down up there by leveraging our federal environmental laws, and requirements that, that impacts be considered before we authorize these kinds of industrial activities. Impacts including global warming impacts and the wildlife and the air quality impacts, with the aim of forcing the government and by extension industries to start to take into account the environmental costs of the coal mining that they're undertaking. We have a lot of progress yet to be made. I mean, I'll be totally honest, but in the last few years, it's been amazing how much things have changed. And just to illustrate this, you know, when we started engaging on coal mine fights in the Western United States, we were facing an Interior Department, because the U.S. Interior Department is the one that manages all the publicly owned coal in the West. We were facing an Interior Department that wouldn't even acknowledge that carbon dioxide emissions would be the result of their mining decisions. They said it was speculative and too far along in the future for them to be able to address. And of course, that's the most idiotic response we ever got. I mean, the coal is mined for one reason. It's to be burned. I don't think that there's a market for decorative coal for landscaping or some other niche market. I think it's just mine to be burned.
Christmas.
That's right. Santa's probably the next biggest customer of the coal industry, giving coal to naughty kids. So I forgot about that. But in general, the coal is mine to be burned. And so we finally got Interior to at least acknowledge, okay, when we approve this mining, it will lead to this much coal burning and likely this much carbon. Now we're at a point where we're now pushing them to come clean with the American public and say, okay, well, what does that mean? How bad is that? And what should you do to respond to that? It's basically what they're saying is, yeah, here's all the bad impacts that are going to happen, but we don't know how bad they're going to be. So we'll just leave it at that. And it's a common excuse from the federal government, in a lot of climate fights right now, where we're trying to hold them accountable in little ways to reducing carbon. And the response is, you know, even if we said no to this, there would be so much carbon that it just wouldn't matter. It's basically all our actions are insignificant. And that's the line from the feds on this, and especially on coal mining, is that it's all insignificant. And of course, with climate change, it's not about looking at one coal lease in isolation. It's about looking at it in the context of the global challenge that we have before us. And that global challenge includes, you know, trying to bring carbon dioxide levels down to 350 parts per million or lower. And, you know, we're struggling to get the feds to acknowledge that any amount of carbon is significant, and therefore any amount of carbon, they should take steps to keep in the ground or limit emissions. It's quite the fight, and it's been frustrating that we made some progress, but it's been, an uphill battle, even in areas like the Powder River Basin, where you can draw, like, there is a clear link between the coal mine and the Powder River Basin and a huge amount of carbon emissions in the U.S. You know, if we stopped coal mining in the Powder River Basin today, we would reduce our carbon footprint by 13%. That's significant. That's not 50%, no, but 13% is nothing to sneeze at. But even then, we haven't been able to get the feds to acknowledge that they can do anything to address that issue. So, we're steadily inching up the pressure, and we're getting some success here and there. I mentioned to you earlier, Derek, that we recently got a court ruling here in Colorado that held an Interior Department coal leasing decision to be illegal because they didn't account for the social cost of carbon. And the social cost of carbon, we know that there's a cost associated with carbon. The feds should be addressing that. But what has happened is that unless there's a quantitative figure to back it up, they can easily reject it. And what's happened is the federal agencies have come up with a way to monetize emissions of carbon. And basically, they affects a dollar figure to every ton of carbon that's released. And it varies, depending on various factors. But it's basically acknowledging that climate change takes a toll on our economy, on the ability of people to enjoy services from the environment. Floods have a cost, heavy snows have a cost, rising sea level has a cost, And the social cost of carbon figure tries to account for that. And we got a federal judge here to overturn, actually totally vacate a co-leasing decision because the feds did not take into account the social cost of carbon before issuing this lease. So we're progressing, but we still have a federal government that's, and in particular land managers, like land and mineral managers like the Interior Department, that refuse to take any responsibility for the carbon that's on their hands, even though you know, all indications are that we could be making tremendous progress in reducing carbon and confronting global warming if we could slow and ultimately stop the flow of fossil fuels from our public lands.
So when you are fighting these battles, how are the local politics? By which I mean, are the communities in the affected regions extremely polarized? Are they primarily, they look at you as this terrible environmentalist who's trying to destroy their life, or they look at you as allies? How does that work usually?
Well, you know, we're working in the rural American West when it comes to these coal mining fights. These coal mining towns, they're out there. They're primarily dependent on coal mining for the most part. And so, no, they don't look upon us too favorably. And, you know, I have sympathies with that. I mean, that they've been relying on an industry to give them work and to help sustain their families for many years. And the coal industry is not being honest with them and not telling them that things are going to change. And the feds, frankly, the federal government is simply going along with the coal industry. And so it's a very frustrating time that we're in where coal miners and communities dependent on coal are facing a lot of uncertainty. And there's a lot of certainty around environmental regulation and recognition around the costs of coal and carbon, but not a lot of certainty in terms of how we as a nation, you know, help those communities and help those workers. And, you know, you could write it off as, well, you know, it's time for the bust. It's time for you know, us to come to the reality that some of these communities and some of these businesses just they're gone. They've done their time. I think there's so much potential in the West for other ways of sustaining communities to take hold. And I see a lot of promise out there. And you know, one area is in Western Colorado, in this area called the North Fork Valley. It's the North Fork of the Gunnison River flows through it, and they have three coal mines. And coal mining has been a big part of the community for many years, but also over the years, the area has come to become a very notable organic farming center in Colorado. It's had many manufacturing businesses come in over the years. You know, very very small manufacturing businesses, but businesses nonetheless, and they have wineries there, and they've developed this economy that's based on the land and on the productivity of the land, on bringing people there to enjoy it. You know, the town there that's I don't know if you know of it, Paonia, Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful place, and they're drawing more people there, and they're selling their community as a gem of Western Colorado because of its organic agriculture and its backdrop. And yet the coal mines are still there, but they're at a point now where the coal mines could go away and this community would thrive still because it has its natural setting and the farming that is now sustaining that area to a large degree. So there's hope, and areas like Paonia, I think, are emblematic of that hope, that yes, you can be dependent on coal, but that doesn't prevent you from ultimately sustaining your community through other ways. And our hope is that by starting to expose the costs of coal and to tell the story about the devastating impacts coal mining can have, that we can convince communities and the federal government to invest more in aiding the transition on the ground away from fossil fuels. But it's tough right now. We're not quite at the point where there's a game plan. And you know, we do need to regulate carbon, and we do need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And at the same time, you know, our federal government and you know, leaders who are ostensibly looking out for communities need to find ways to give these communities a chance at a new way of living. I mean, that's what we're advocating. I wish we could do more, but you know, the urgency now is to confront the carbon, and we need to be doing that. And we can't wait. We can't wait to keep carbon in the ground until we have the fully fleshed out blueprint for moving away from coal. Sometimes the best way to move to a new way of generating energy or a new way of sustaining a community takes fomenting crisis and exposing liabilities. And that's what we're trying to do right now. And some of these communities will move on to bigger and better things, and others may not. But we do need to at least acknowledge the carbon challenge ahead of us.
A couple things. One of them is that, you know, it's really clear to me that capitalism is based on subsidies. And it seems that it would be so easy, if this culture were sane, to just switch the subsidies. Instead of handing over money, instead of the federal government subsidizing the coal mines, why don't the federal government subsidize the transition to a sane society? It just seems pretty straightforward to me. Okay, that's one thing. The next thing, but of course, if we had that, you know, I mean, if we were that sane in the first place, we wouldn't be doing this in the first place. So that's one thing. And the next thing is that it's, you know, you said this, that you see the current crisis as this is what you need to do. And I think that that's so important. And I think we need to recognize that we all have different roles. And, you know, your role can be to try to stop the coal. And it's somebody else's job to figure out how to make the economy. You don't, to make an, make a local economy that works. You know, it's like, you can't do everything. And it's the same with me. You know, I can't do everything, and no single activist can do everything. You know, we all have to play our roles in this. And I'm just valid, you know, sort of saying the same thing you did, except in a different way. And then I guess, do you want to respond to that? And then I got one final question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're exactly right. And, you know, part of it too needs to be, we need to agitate to the point that, that the costs start to be taken into account, more legitimately by people in power. Not to get sidetracked, but this has come up with oil and confronting fracking in the American West. And people say, well, what's your solution to oil? And I have to honestly say, like, I don't know. I don't know what the solution to oil is. You know, so much is dependent on oil. But what I do know is that we will never come up with an alternative or a solution unless we start to agitate and unless we start to expose liabilities around oil production and draw out the real costs. Then will we inspire innovation and activism and creativity that will help us move beyond oil. And it's the same thing with coal. Only by agitating will we foment the type of inspiration needed to truly move beyond it at a scale that's needed to respond to the global warming crisis that's in front of us.
Well, I think that's great and really important. And the last question is basically the last question I always ask. And the reason I always ask it is because I want people to get off their butts and do something. And so I would like to ask you the same question I asked you when we talked before, that both for people in the affected areas and for people elsewhere in the United States and in the world, what do you want them to do to help with this struggle?
Well, I think they need to start recognizing that, you know, the mining that's happening here, the mining of coal and the ultimate burning of coal, they have a stake in it. These are public lands. They're public minerals. We all own them. We have a say in how they're disposed of or not disposed of. So the more people realize that, and the more people can speak out with that in mind, the better. Right now, you know, these issues are relevant mainly in Wyoming or Colorado, but these should be national issues. The nation should be up in arms over what's happening here. And if anybody in the U.S. cares about what a coal-fired power plant is doing to their community, they should care about what's happening at the mining end of things. And so that would be the overarching call to action, is that don't just make it about the power plant, make it about the whole chain, the whole footprint of the coal industry. Because you're not, you know, you can plug up all these smokestacks, but if you don't confront the entire chain, industry is likely to just find a new way to stay relevant. And I mentioned exports earlier. We're seeing this. Coal-fired power plants are being shut down in the U.S. So what's happening? Coal companies are finding ways to sell their products overseas. So we've almost created an entirely new challenge on our hands. but also, you know, promoting clean energy. And this is the thing with, you know, I mentioned oil earlier, but with coal, we have alternatives. We have solar, we have wind. We know how to turn off a light switch, for Christ's sake. I mean, we have these opportunities ahead of us, these clean energy solutions right here. And, people can start to support those, embrace them, develop them to the extent that they can, get their communities, you know, getting your community, even your small city council, maybe to adopt a resolution, setting a renewable energy standard for the city. And or adopting a proclamation saying that this is a coal-free community. All that stuff adds up to a very big statement, which is that the nation and the Western United States have had enough with coal, and that's not where our future lies. So, you know, there's so many ways, but I think it's mostly coming at it from the perspective of this bigger picture, understanding that that smokestack that you don't like is tied to something much bigger, and that if you get to that much bigger prize, you can have a much bigger impact at the end of the day.
Well, thank you so much, and I would like to thank you for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jeremy Nichols. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.